Change doesn't wait. Sometimes it storms in, sometimes it creeps quietly, unfolding in ways we notice later. It stirs in boardrooms, classrooms, streets, and communities, wherever people act with purpose. What moves you? A vision? A challenge? A belief in business as a force for good? And what holds you back? External factors or limiting beliefs? I'm Gary Watts, and this is Moved, the podcast of 289 people inspiring change. I'll be speaking with people exploring what first moved them, what they've achieved, and the challenges they've had to overcome, both outside and within. Each episode is about human performance, leadership, sustainability, doing the work that matters, and the moments that change everything. This is Moved. Madeline McLaughlin is an award-winning, multidisciplinary designer, researcher, and entrepreneur with a strong focus on scaling positive impact. She's worked on global safety solutions, including tsunami safety centers and sea safety technologies. Her career actually began in disaster zones in Japan and Italy, where she co-designed resilience and recovery strategies with survivors. She's a seasoned expert in server design, a wonderful guest to have on the show. It's a fabulous conversation. I hope you enjoy.
Okay.
Happy?
Absolutely.
Very good. So Maddie, we've met a few times. We met at the Design Museum in London, and we've met a few other times. The Design Museum was when you put that a brilliant event on. It was really good to be at that, and I've been looking forward to this conversation with you.
Oh, well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honour to be part of this.
It's an absolute pleasure. And I was looking at the guests I've spoken with so far and the people that are coming up next, and you're the first person that's got such a strong design background. And then I was looking at how you describe it, and actually I remember when we spoke, you described it as meaningful positive change through design. So I thought that would be a brilliant place to start. Positive change through design and what that means to you.
Absolutely. Well, for me, I come from a family of nurses, and I've never had the stomach for that work. So I've had to find other ways of helping people and carrying on the family legacy, so to speak. So
yeah.
Design was my calling, and I've found opportunities to use design and creative thinking to save lives or help people become more resilient. That's the way that I use design and creative thinking.
Wow. Yeah. Design and creative thinking to save lives. And interestingly, you're not the first person to come on and mention either nursing or medical background but didn't quite have the stomach for it. It seems like quite a number of people I was speaking to have got that background in the family but then make a change.
Absolutely. Which they're a different breed of people that can do that work. I have so much respect, but as soon as they bring it to the dinner table, I'm sorry, that's where I draw the line. The stories they share at the dinner table are things that I'll save for another day, but the work that they do, saving lives on a daily basis and having such an impact on communities, the things that go on within the science involved in innovation within those sectors, the impact it can have, it's inspirational and something that I channel different avenues, but it's always in the back of my mind. We've got a responsibility whilst we're on this planet, so let's see what we can do.
Definitely. So a responsibility while we're on this planet, where did that first come from for you then?
So for me, I started early on in my kind of design career and aspiration of that. At the age of about 4, I started doing architectural drawings with my dad as a building surveyor. So having a go at designing my dream house. And in those early years of doing sort of work experience, going to architects and being on site, I thought that was what I wanted to do until I got given a brief to go and design tsunami escape routes over in Japan. So I'd had the opportunity to be involved in big bougie offices in London that were just being redone for the sake of being redone, but was given the opportunity to go to a whole new part of the world for me, embrace a completely different culture, and look at small design interventions that can have a massive impact. And that is something that sits with me, looking at impact is key for every project I do, but that was a key moment for me where everything shifted.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you started around the age of 4 and you were designing your dream house. Are you in that house now?
Maybe similar.
On the way there.
Maybe not. But yes, it was a really exciting opportunity to start so early with a passion and a drive, and to be supported with that and have opportunities to learn quick and be fast in making choices around things that I wanted to follow and have a go at. I feel that was a real luxury of the upbringing that I had, my dad being within the building industry, to have those opportunities, but to go beyond that and look at impact and look at strategy, innovation, resilience, and understand infrastructures that have to be in place for that to be possible.
Yeah, yeah. That's really interesting then, the intersection that arose there. And so that first opportunity, I say opportunity, but tsunami escape routes, such an interesting and important thing. And with Japan, where did that opportunity come from?
So that opportunity came from a project whilst I was at university. So I was doing a bachelor's degree at Chelsea University in interior and spatial design. And it was a short brief that was set up for people to apply and get a position on the team that was going to be sent off to Japan for an extended period of time to work with the community as well as local survivors in understanding what we can do to prevent life loss in the future. So I was lucky enough to be one of the 3 selected students from the university.
Wow.
And whilst we were over there, we stayed in one of the hotels that was hit by the tsunami and introduced to videos of exactly what happened to people in that building on that day. And it was just an absolute culture shock, yes, that the pride that they all took in surviving what they did, and the honour in which they're looking to help the community and still thriving post-disaster and it being a safe place. It was something I'd never seen before. And it's why I've moved towards environmental psychology, looking at researching before designing and creating. That's something that can often be skipped, and something that I had the opportunity to really get my teeth into whilst I was there. But build relationships and build understandings around empathy and culture. Those things, if they're missing, it can be absolutely detrimental.
Absolutely. How long was the project for you?
So the project, it was in different blocks over a period of about 5 years. So initially it was a quick research project over there in which we scoped out the site, looked at the opportunities, met various community members. And whilst I was there, I was also looking at the relief structures that were put in place post-disaster, which they were referred to as coffins. So there were more people that died in the following months after the tsunami than the tsunami itself, because of the environments and the fractures within the communities that were created. So I ended up doing some research on the impact of those kind of post-disaster infrastructures and the psychology of that, exactly what was going on, which then led on to the architectural concepts being proposed and exhibited around the world. But some years later, supported a charity called Atlantic Pacific, which was set up based in that community to help people in that community in having infrastructures in place for tsunamis. So lifeboats can be deployed, and just looking at ways of helping people and making the most of the beautiful area, but preventing life loss. So there was an architectural project which came into play probably about 2 years ago now, in which it was a competition asking for architects all around the world to put their concepts out as to a tsunami safety centre. And working with Atlantic Pacific and some fantastic architects, we've then brought these ideas to the community, which are now being put forward for hopefully being built very soon as one of the first in the area, which it's an ongoing lifelong project for me. Whenever I get a calling from the community or the charities, I'll always say yes.
An ongoing lifelong project. since that first, since the, yeah, you won a three from Chelsea University. But it's had such an impact on you that that's always a thread now. Yeah, I never really, it's not really a thing I would ever think of really post-disaster infrastructure, but as you start to describe it, like it does come alive really. What would you say was the real impact or benefit of that first work that you did in Japan? I know you're now talking about things being instantiated globally, but what would you say was the kind of real impact and benefit from that work?
That's a great question. I think one of the key things that was a real moment of realization for me was when I found out that some of the post-disaster relief that was deployed was actually declined by communities. So you have these massive organizations and charities that want to be the first on site providing whatever resources they've got. However, a lot of it went to waste because communities said, we don't need this, we're fine, we're rebuilding. Mm-hmm. And the cultural aspects of the deployment had meant, of course, there was a massive financial loss, but it has such an impact on those individuals as well. Mm. They take pride in supporting each other and rebuilding each other. And that's something that I wanted to understand more. There's an assumption that there's this victimhood exploitation that we see through the media. However, there are survivors and people that are trying to support each other and crystallizing in these new communities.
Yeah.
That's something to understand and support.
Yeah.
And that's a lot harder to do through just sending products and sending units for people to live in straight away.
Yeah, that sounds profound. It really makes sense as you describe that. So that, you know, I guess with the disaster, there's been a real breakdown, there's been a real, you know, breaking apart of some of the things that was there, including certain community aspects and so on. But in that reforming, it's really, really key for the people that are there. They would want that account, you know, I'm sure want and need support in many guises, but crucially, it's their community. They've been impacted. They want to be part of reforming the kind of new order.
Exactly that. And it's not necessarily unique to Japan.
No.
So I've worked across over in Syria, winterizing shelters with the Red Cross and Foster and Partners. Mm. And the shelters that were created needed to have divides within those spaces for men and women at certain times. That wasn't something put in place, but these interventions, ensuring that culturally they're being respectful and ensuring that people can get on with their lives as they need to. That's something that was part of that project. But with the likes of Italy working over there, they had many earthquakes in 2016.
Right.
So with that, we were able to reflect on the earthquakes that had come before then and speak to communities as to how they rebuilt and share that information with survivors from the most recent earthquakes. So reducing this filtering and framing that's going on, if anything, it's helping communities connect and share and support each other, that it doesn't necessarily sound like a design project.
No.
But if we look at services and systems, then absolutely it becomes part of it. And if anything, can be even more impactful.
Yeah. Yeah. Did the Syria and the Italy work follow on from Japan?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can tell that I then found projects that were popping up and sought opportunities to be able to learn more and understand better, to be able to carry that from project to project. So the interventions may have been smaller, but that's with an understanding that I've still got plenty to learn, and I'm happy to be in environments where I am learning and taking on that feedback. And I think that's what it is to be an innovator or a critical thinker. You need to constantly be challenging what you know and looking for new opportunities to evolve that.
Yeah, definitely. So like design then, because design can almost feel, you know, quite abstract, quite conceptual in some respects. Can you bring alive like the role that design played in some of these projects that you did in either Japan or Italy?
Absolutely.
The importance of it.
Yeah, I think design, if I were to condense it down or find a new way of framing it, is problem solving. And that's exactly what good design should do. Really great design, you shouldn't notice. It should just happen and your life should feel better because of it. So design as a methodology for helping people, coming back to the nursing legacy that I have behind me is finding ways of people having better lives in whatever capacity that is. So that for me is exactly what design should be doing.
Yeah. What are the best examples of like great design that, you know, if you think of great design and it makes you feel alive, what kind of things would you draw on to illustrate it?
I think some of the best examples of great design are around inclusivity, accessibility, because that's an opportunity to focus on really specific engagement scenarios, people that are excluded from certain environments, opportunities, and being able to give them opportunities to become involved in whatever those aspects are. So the likes of AI and accessibility is such an exciting space to be in right now.
Yeah.
There are people who are potentially going to be given the opportunity to see again through these nanotechnologies that are being developed, which is absolutely mind-boggling. And design is involved within those processes, innovation, collaboration, ensuring that we are considering the human impacts. That's all part of the process. And I think that's a space I'm so excited to see what's going to happen. And additionally, we've got so many things happening in the global sphere around movement, displacement, and there are so many opportunities for designers, creatives to support things like policy. So that's a really exciting place, that places like Policy Lab with .gov. You can see loads of resources, but that's where designers and service designers come into their element, looking beyond the physical things you see around you and go into those systems and services that enable us to have the lives that we do.
Yeah, wow. In terms of accessibility, that's another of the times we actually met in person, wasn't it? The Accessibility Discovery Centre. And that, I must admit, that really came alive for me in terms of all the kind of innovations and things that, because in some respects, it can be an underserved, huge segment of the population in terms of touch and sight and so on. But yeah, so it's really interesting the work that you're doing in that field as well.
Yeah, it's such an exciting space to be able to help people that haven't been able to engage in certain parts of, I don't know, culture, environments, whatever it is, to be able to pick up a phone or to be able to go about their lives and grab a bus for the first time on their own without assistance, or to sit in a car on their own because they're now in a driverless car to get from A to B. That independence is something we can often take for granted. And what a gift to be able to give that back to people. And that's what I think great design can be doing. And Chris Patno, who's over at Google, is a fantastic example of someone to listen to and follow for the work that they are doing and the opportunities they're creating for people to thrive and be independent.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually met him with you, didn't I? And he was a wonderful person to meet. And you're making me think now, actually, he'd probably be an ideal person to also speak to. But that's maybe a separate thing for later. But your work obviously inspires you, energizes you, what you're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I get excited by new challenges or things that are referred to as wicked problems.
Right.
So wicked problems being things that apparently can't be solved. There's no solution. We don't know what to do. That's my perfect brief. And that's how I came across my first business, which was where a wicked problem was brought to me at university in a 2-week design challenge.
Yeah. I'll have to ask, what was there? Because something that can't be solved, or they didn't think it could be solved. What was the wicked problem?
So an organization called the Lloyd's Register Foundation
had
gone to multiple maritime architects and various maritime architect universities and whatnot, putting design challenges out to them, looking at how to save lives at sea. And it was to do with a very specific interaction, which is people going to and from boats whilst those ships are moving out at sea.
Yeah.
So it's quite a dangerous, precarious environment to be in. But it was a brief that was brought to us whilst we were at the Royal College of Art. And that 2-week design study of exactly what happens out there, coming to understand what the problems were. The team that I was in, we came up with a novel solution that actually reduced risk by 80%. Wow. And we were the first people to look at the rigging of the ladder on the deck as opposed to the ladder itself that someone would climb up.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, a two-week project became 2 months with a bit of investment from Lloyd's Register. 2 years later, we were asked to turn it into a product for it to be on all of the ships in the world. And
wow.
5 years later, we're patented and going into safety regulation at the moment and set up for distribution very
yeah.
soon. So
wow.
an example of a wicked problem that got very much out of hand, but a really exciting opportunity to take an idea to an actual product out there saving lives.
Yeah, that is absolutely amazing. And that is, you know, the requirement there is huge, isn't it? You think of sea rescue, it's probably on a, you know, unfortunately on a pretty much a daily basis, I imagine, anywhere, you know, coastal. So sea rescue, and actually, like you say, the safety of the people also doing the rescuing, as well as the people you are trying to save. Immediately, you imagine, you know, it's dangerous environment. So you're doing something there that massively 80%, you know, reduce the risk, and that's now being, you know, rolled out onto all of those ships. That's
yeah,
good work.
Thank you. Which there yeah. were so many things covered within that project as well, because we had, of
yeah.
course, the safety of those individuals going about their work on a daily basis. But you would also have the ships that would be sat waiting to come into port. And if anything went wrong, they'd have to stay out there for longer. And the emissions that come off of these ships being sat out there is significant, we'll say.
Yeah.
But so we were able to support sustainability as well through us creating efficiencies just through this locking mechanism, which is my favourite part of the project. It's a tiny element of this massive ship in operation that can have an impact for the lives, sustainability and the economy.
Sometimes it could just be really simple, powerful products or design thinking that changes things for the economy.
Exactly that.
Yeah,
exactly,
you've really brought
that.
It alive. That's fantastic. It doesn't sound necessarily easy work. You know, you mentioned working in disaster zones like Japan, Italy and Syria, and some of the, you know, things to do with sea safety and, you know, rescuing. Does it ever, you know, it can't be easy, some of that kind of work in the environments that you're in and the things that you're thinking about. How do you manage that?
That's a really good question, and a question that I get asked quite a lot, and I think my answer changes the older I get.
Oh, does it?
But initially, I was in such a position to learn and soak everything in and understand from people. I'm very much a people person. Everyone has something interesting about them. It's just a case of finding it. Mm. And I've never had to push hard to find it. There are so many fascinating people that I've met along the way who have been very supportive of me learning from them as well. So with that in mind, the stories that they've shared with me, what they've invested in me understanding about their scenarios, I feel a responsibility to continue to use that to help others or find ways to pay it back. So hence why I say the likes of the work I've done in Japan, for me, that will be a lifelong project and ongoing, because there are communities that have made me the designer that I am. And
yeah.
I'll continue to take that learning into every project I do. And that's how I guess, deal with those really kind of harrowing environments, being there a week after, 2 weeks after an earthquake in Italy, with firemen still removing bodies from the ruins, and being there as a young designer and researcher. It's the reality of what's going on there. And it's part of why it's important for us to remain human-centered in everything that we do. Being designers, we can often feel like the environments we're creating, especially in the field of interiors and architecture, that's enough. There's so much more we have to understand about what the needs of people are to be able to create spaces, create services, or create anything that actually has a positive impact, because it can be detrimental if we don't, with the thousands of people that committed suicide following the earthquake because of the environment they were put in Japan.
Yeah.
That's a statistic that will sit in my head forever, as a reminder of the responsibility that we have and the impact. So I'll continue to use all of those stories, all of the research that I've done, to hopefully create better services and design better for people.
Wow. That's so powerful, some of the things that you're sharing there, Maddie. So those experiences, even as a, you know, young and early designer, that some of those experiences, you recognise that that shaped the designer or who you are and the designer you've become. And so there's that part of giving back. One, you know, they've shaped you, and so as you become, you know, I guess stronger and more experienced, you feel a responsibility back to those communities and other communities, that kind of giving back piece. And then you also powerfully, you know, illustrated how, you know, design is not something that, you know, is done in a separate room, like away from people. Is like a separate thing. It meets people. It's about, you know, not just humans, I'm sure, but like humans and where it meets. And yeah, so it's really powerful stuff. Are there many people like you doing this kind of work, like design meets positive impact, or what does the field look like?
Oh, absolutely. There are plenty of people doing it, and doing it in very different ways as well. So I'd been invited to the Royal College of Art to work on some social innovation projects. So looking at COVID and how people were dealing with COVID. With COVID during the years that we were all in lockdown, but also looking at social housing and the various environments that people were working their way through. So I've worked with fantastic innovators at the Royal College of Art doing amazing research. And of course, universities are a really great place to look for people that are creating positive impacts. They all have responsibilities to be out there making a difference with the research they're doing. But I would always wave the flag for the Royal College of Art as an alumni, of course.
Yeah.
But the work that I got to do whilst I was at the Helen Hamlin Centre for Design.
Yeah.
There are fantastic people there working across accessibility, sustainability, neurodiversity. And they're making a real dent, and impact is there. And they are very much about co-design and collaboration. So for anyone listening that is interested, please do see what the Helen Hamlin Centre of Design are doing and get in contact with their researchers. They're very accessible, but we can only make real change when we collaborate. Multidisciplinary design is where things actually come to life, where we have expertise from different fields coming together, not just designers. But working across sectors, that's where magic can really happen.
Yeah, amazing. I'll make sure I put those kind of things in the show notes. Yeah, I could be designing. You know, I would have thought that most people inherently, it's quite normal, I think, for people to appreciate design, beautiful design, and so on, and useful design, and things that make a difference. People appreciate, have an eye for that, I think, in general. But actually, going into it as a career or thinking about it as something that you want to kind of bring to life in your work, sometimes people, you know, imagine in a way that some people think, I'm not creative or I'm not a designer and would like to be, but actually probably everyone is creative. And could everyone be involved?
Absolutely, everyone can be creative. For anyone who is doubting that, go on to Adobe's Creative Types. And you can do a little Myers-Briggs test to see what kind of creative you are, which, of course, we're all different types of creatives. But coming back to my first point, what is design? What's creativity? It's problem solving. That will be different in different industries, different sectors. So I would reassure everyone that we can all be creatives. It's just your discipline, how you get that down or how you share that and create those things for people. It will be different. That's all.
Fabulous. Right. I've never done the Adobe Creatives thing, so I'm going to do that. What type are you? Not that I know the types yet, but I'll find out.
So my one, I might have to check it, whether it comes to mind or not now, but mine was very much to do with being empathic and someone who looks at problem solving specifically, that works with teams in bringing them together. So I think it was reformer, which is a niche term to be using in this political sphere. But
right.
It's to do with kind of reformation. So when things are broken, I'll come in and I'll fix things and put it back together again in the best way possible.
Love that. Things are broken, you fix it in the best way possible. That's a good skill to have. Very good. So your work these days, I think, am I right to say that it's Helm and SDU Global, the kind of two of the main projects that you're involved in at the moment?
Absolutely. So Helm, I am the CEO of the organisation in which we have the product. The patent is very much there. It's now working with our fantastic manufacturers and distributors to get the product out there. So
it's the sea safety one, isn't it?
At the moment. Exactly. Yeah. So bringing the products out to ships. So working with fantastic partners who are now taking on that part, with it being their field of expertise, but all of the insights in building a business, developing ideas, problem solving, having to figure out the whole picture is now something that I'm able to do with S2 Global, where every day is a new challenge. I get to work with lots of fantastic organizations, whether they're large corporates or SMEs, in which they'll come to us with challenges, whether they're looking to scale their business, start a business, look at changing the business completely. They'll come through either shorter programs or long format programs, in which we'll use design thinking to help them in whatever their aim is. So it's really exciting to help them in identifying where the problem areas are and coming to the end of it with a well-rounded solution based on the design principles that we use in industry.
Yeah. For the uninitiated or people who've heard the term but, you know, don't fully know exactly what it means, can you describe design thinking for us?
Absolutely. So design thinking, there are processes involved within this. So things like the Design Council's Double Diamond is a really good example of a process in which you can guide yourself through design thinking. And it's an opportunity for you to de-risk anything that you're creating through going through different steps. So you will discover, define, develop, and deliver. That's the order in which you go through the Double Diamond process. But you're discovering exactly what the challenge areas are. You're defining where you can have an impact. You're developing those prototypes to figure out with the users exactly how this will work. And deliver, of course, does what it says on the tin. And there's plenty of space for iteration, but this model aligns really well with innovation models and things that organizations may be slightly more familiar with. But through using design, you give people the opportunity to be creative, think outside the box, think of different industries. So that term design can be really useful in getting people to shake their inhibitions off and actually big picture thinking.
Yeah, I love it. So, and the applicability of that is, like you say, quite vast. You know, really the whole economy, you know, startups, organizations that are scaling, corporates, individuals and so on. Design thinking, innovation. What would you say is actually the state of play? Because still it seems, you know, quite clearly there's demand for organizations to get help with these kind of fields.
So the state of play with design thinking is it's happening. There are organizations that are leading innovation, and it's because they are bringing in design thinking. They're upskilling their teams with the tools used in innovation and design thinking for them to bring into their own challenges. So all different parts of organizations have the opportunity to take on learning from design thinking to de-risk. It's exactly about that. It's looking at how we invest our time, our thoughts, our money at the end of the day to be able to create more resilient products and services and more resilient businesses that actually provide what the customers need. So that across the board applies to everything, whether it's internal systems and services or what our customers are using. So we've worked across multiple industries, whether it's finance, insurance, design. Florists are a fantastic asset. I didn't assume, but the florists that we've worked with have been fantastic. But people in security, there's such a broad range of people that we're working with. But design thinking within any industry will have an impact.
Yeah.
And it's been evident across the people we've got to work with who have gone on to create whole new business ventures as a result of finding what the actual problem is, that small thing that can have a massive impact, focusing on that. And it's amazing to see what people do. But that's what design thinking does. It shows you what that tiny thing is that can have a massive impact. And that's the thing to focus on.
Yeah, so important in the UK economy or in any economy.
Yeah. Any economy, yeah, absolutely.
Can you tell us about the florist? You know, can you bring that one to life? Oh, not necessarily naming any names.
Yeah, I won't name names on this one, but there's a florist that has come to mind who the challenge area was that people weren't using florists on the high street.
Right.
So because of that, it was having a real impact. But she came onto one of our programs looking to diversify her customers and has ended up doing some fantastic work in the TV and film industry, as well as now looking at automation and massive contracts with large organizations that have been inspired by her approach in innovating in the industry. So I can't say much more than that for now, but I hope that she shares more about it soon, because it's really exciting to see how the incremental steps that she's taken to push herself out of her comfort zone and really challenge what it is to be a florist within that role.
Yeah.
And go well beyond it. She's fantastic.
Wow. So if there are people listening to this now or when it goes out and they're, you know, they're in an organization, might be their organization or they're supporting an organization, and they're thinking, this sounds really interesting, but I don't think we're doing this where we work, whether it's a product business or a service business or whatever it is, what would you say to them in terms of what they might be missing out on, but also how to start?
Well, of course, I would say to get in contact. If you're looking to start design thinking and innovation and you'd like to look for new opportunities, then collaboration is key. Having the support, the infrastructure in place to be able to take it step by step to make sure that you're making informed decisions that align to the viability and feasibility of the organization. That's exactly the design thinking process that we take people through. So yes, at S2 we do work with massive corporates that will design bespoke programs with them and for them, but also we'll use similar formulas for boot camps for funded learners that can come on programs for peanuts that can get the most out of that learning and come out with these really ambitious, inspirational ideas that actually come to life and have an impact.
Yeah.
So my advice would be look for those people that are there to support you.
Yeah.
And we are absolutely those people. And I'm always happy to be contacted and have conversations. Like I said, there are so many people doing fantastic things out there. The more we can do to support each other, the more impact we can have.
Yeah, which is exactly why I wanted to invite you on here. Because I knew about this, like the unique background of the intersection with design and impact. And that's exactly why I wanted you on. And I've actually worked, as you know, obviously I've, you know, been on some of S2's programs as well. And, you know, no affiliation, but connect, a firm, really, really powerful and unique. You know, you put really, really good things together at whatever stage people are at. So, yeah, I've been very, really impressed with the team that I've seen that you're working with. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good to
hear. Yeah, definitely. So you're having such a diverse and interesting, powerful like career. What comes next for you? Are there things you still want, you know, that you think, I really want to do this or that?
Oh, absolutely. There are so many things that I'd love to do, and I'm really bad at saying no. That's why I've got to do so many things so far. But there's still so much more to do. And the likes of the United Nations and various organisations that are looking at the biggest picture that they possibly can and looking at impact, I think that's a sphere one day I'd love to work my way towards.
Yeah.
But until then, I'm still building. There's still plenty more to learn and plenty of inspirational people that I'm lucky enough to work with at the moment that their impact will resonate. And that's one of the key things in my eyes, being able to move to a space of educating right now, working with the likes of S2, imparting the knowledge that I've gathered over the years from industry, sharing those frameworks for others to use in their own context. That then resonates and has a positive impact. So that will continue to be my focus, looking for those micro events that can scale and have bigger impact.
Love it.
Anyone comes forward with that, I'll say yes.
Very good. I don't think we've ever had the United Nations chat before, have we? So, but like, tell me about the what you see when you kind of look at that and the various, I guess, things that they're convening, trying to, looking to convene to, make things better.
Yeah, absolutely. Which the work I was doing back in Japan and the research I was doing was very much focused on the data around fatalities, looking at the investment in the post-disaster relief and the narrative that came through from the United Nations. The data sets will sit with me. As I mentioned, there were thousands of people that died in the tsunami, but even more that died in the following months from suicides. And that is to do with the disaster relief provided. And I would like to better understand how to prevent scenarios like that in the future. So being involved in looking at disaster relief is something I'd love to be able to be involved in the future. However, you don't necessarily have to travel across to Japan or Italy to experience a disaster. We have things happening back here in the UK, and my focus post-COVID was looking at the financial crisis that we're facing. There are plenty of things happening back here, and being able to support SMEs, people that are unemployed getting jobs again, being able to upskill people to hold resilience in a world where AI is evolving, jobs will be changing. So, in terms of looking at resilience and helping people, that's something that impacts. I'm confident that we're having that at S2. So, that's my channel for now.
Yeah, there's vital work in a lot of places, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Amazing. Maddie, it's such a good, interesting conversation. I'm so glad that you're able to join me on this.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. It's lovely to reflect on these things too. So thank you.
Yeah, no, absolute pleasure. So if people want to find out more, like you've obviously mentioned some things in our conversation, but where would they go?
Well, I would say, first of all, get in contact. I am a friendly face that actually looks at their LinkedIn messages. So feel free to drop me a message if you have listened to this. It would be lovely to hear from you, most of all. But there are fantastic places and resources that I've mentioned. Places like the Helen Hamlin Centre for Design, if you're looking for fantastic research and designers making an impact. If you're looking for support in innovating or bringing design thinking and innovation into your organisation, get in contact with us at S2. We've got plenty on offer. For small organisations, large organisations, we're here to help everyone and deploy the knowledge and share more about design thinking and the impacts that it can have in your industries.
Yeah, love that. And when you're looking to the next, this year and the next couple of years, what are you most excited about?
Oh, what am I most excited about? We have various cohorts that have been with us on the apprenticeship. That have come from different organisations that will be graduating very soon. So I have to say, I'm very excited for them to see what they've done with the whole programme and to see what they do next. I think that's just me being the empath, and as I said, the resonating impact. It's really nice to be able to see people taking that knowledge and doing something with it to see what comes next. So it'll be credit to them, but I look forward to seeing it.
Well, the empath definitely comes through, whether it's through, one of your potential paths originally might have been nursing, but the work you were doing in disaster zones through to, you know, creating something that's had an impact on sea safety and sea rescue, and then the interest in the people that are going through these, you know, the programs that you're doing now, the empath bit comes through. I will do my Adobe creative assessment and I'll let you know what I got. I think I've got a bit of empath in there as well, but whether I'm that one or something else, I'm not sure. I'll share it with you when I have it.
Let me know.
Yeah, I will do. Maddie, it's been absolutely fabulous to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you once again for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Moved. If it sparks something for you, subscribe and share it with someone who's looking to make a difference. I'm Gary Watts, and I'll see you next time as we explore what moves people and ideas forward.